Hello and welcome to Subject to Change with me, Russell Hogg. My guest today is Roger Crowley. He's a prolific writer of history, focusing mainly on the Mediterranean in the Middle Ages. His work has covered the history of Venice, the siege of Constantinople, and the end of the Crusader kingdoms. Today we're going to talk about the struggle for control of the seas between the Ottoman Turks and Christendom that took place in the early to mid-1500s, and which Roger described in his hugely successful book, Empires of the Sea. So, welcome, Roger, to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Russell. I'm delighted to be here talking to you.
As I say, we're going to be talking about the wars between the Turks and Christendom in the mid-1500s that took place in the Mediterranean. And your book is full of stories and battles which almost defy belief. I mean, some of it is just astonishing stuff. But before we get onto that, I thought it would be helpful for people if we could maybe give them some context to help orientate us in the period and in the geography. And it's not a fair question because I'm asking you to condense a vast amount into just a few minutes, but I thought it might help just to give a brief history of the advance of Islam, the taking of Constantinople, and the ebb and flow of the Crusades, and where we are now in the balance of power between the two principal sides.
Yes, I mean, the backstory of the Mediterranean really is locked into its physical nature, which of course is a very narrow sea in which peoples are separated by very small distances. And this, obviously, if you look over the span of human history, has great potential for trade. The spread of religions, Christianity, is spread around the Mediterranean by sea, but also for warfare. And it's really two seas, actually. The Eastern Mediterranean and the Western Mediterranean are quite different in their currents, in their winds, and in their possibilities. The only people who have succeeded in controlling the whole sea in historical time, of course, are the Romans. And they did a fairly good job of managing the whole of the Mediterranean Sea, particularly the grain trade. Rome requires a vast amount of produce. So piracy comes into this story very early on. The pirates lurk in every creek and crenellation of the Mediterranean, if you look in history. So we see the Romans getting control of this sea. And the decline of the Romans, we move into through a number of different phases, chaotic internecine struggles around its shores. Then we see the rise of Islam, and Islam manages to really dominate the sea from southern Spain all the way around the coast of North Africa and those stepping stone islands in the middle, the Balearic Islands, Malta, Sicily, Crete. And of course, we've really rather forgotten about that. The comeback, of course, comes with the Crusades, when the Crusaders, who work out pretty quickly that slogging round Europe by land to get to the Holy Land is hard work. And we see the comeback of a Christian sea, which is really controlled and managed and provisioned by the Italian maritime states, Venice, Pisa, and Genoa. We come to the period when the Turks are starting to advance to the Mediterranean, and of course they take Constantinople in 1453. And this really is the point, I think, at which my book opens, because the Turks, who are a people of the steppe with no experience of seafaring, find themselves staring at what they call the White Sea. But these are people with a evolving conquest project, you might say, which is hardwired into their sultanate. And it becomes the prerogative of every new sultan, every new Ottoman sultan, with the conquest of Constantinople in 1453, to add territory. And that territory is really going to involve control of large parts of the Mediterranean for various reasons. And that's really where my book starts. I think we could say we start with Mehmet II, 1453, arriving in Constantinople, standing on the roof of the Hagia Sophia Mosque, and looking out over the sea. And what happens in the wake of that is going to become the subject of a very large contest for control of territory, of islands, and of trade.
Now, one of the first battles or first incidents you talk about is the Siege of Rhodes. And it really surprised me when I looked on the map in the book, because Rhodes is, it's within easy sight, is it not, of the mainland. And I was quite surprised to learn that the Christians were still there. I don't know when it was, 1500, and what was the date of the Siege of Rhodes?
About 1520.
Right. I was very surprised to see that they were still so close to the Turkish mainland that Christendom was still in control there.
Yes. The Knights of St. John, who held Rhodes, a sort of freak remnant of the crusading era, really. They, having been pushed out of the Holy Land, they figured out that their survival depended upon a commitment to continuing crusade. The Templars didn't get this, and they got liquidated effectively. But the Knights of St. John actually conquered Christian Rhodes from the Greeks and set up as a kind of front line of Christendom. To a certain extent, it's a propaganda job to get funds, but they can make, they're only 16 miles off the coast of what is now the Ottoman Empire, but they can, they're maritime crusaders, effectively, but they can create a great deal of trouble off the coast of Turkey, because Istanbul depends upon wheat from North Africa. And it's also the main Hajj route from Istanbul to Mecca and Medina, going to Alexandria. And the knights sit in the middle of this on their little island, and they can inflict quite a lot of damage on the economy and also the prestige of the Ottoman sultans by grabbing passing Hajj ship. And so there they are, the shield of Christendom, as the Pope called them, committed to crusade. About 500 of them from all the countries of Western Europe, creating quite a lot of mayhem. And they are a problem for the Ottoman sultans, which they are going to have to deal with, both from the point of view of grain security and from religious prestige. They can't have this little crusading enclave interfering with their business just 60 miles off the coast. And in fact, for a while, the Knights of St. John also had a fort on mainland Turkey at a place called Bodrum, St. Peter's Fort. So this is a thorn in the side of the Ottoman sultans as we come towards the end of the 15th century.
At that time, what is the balance of power between sort of defense and offense? Because at certain periods in history, it's easier to attack and storm fortifications than others. So what's the state of play at the time of the Knights of St. John on Rhodes?
It's very interesting, actually, because the fortifications of Rhodes are on the cusp of development of military engineering. In 1480, Mehmet the Conqueror had an attempt on Rhodes, which he didn't take. But the walls of Castle of Rhodes are really quite thin. They were the old medieval walls, the walls which Constantinople had, which could be brought down very easily by gun fire. By the 1520s, by the start of the 16th century, Rhodes has become a kind of laboratory of development of military engineering. And we're moving into the age of low contoured bastions with angled facades, wide fields of fire, and much harder, very thick bastions, quite low, much harder for gunfire cannon to deal with. And so they're pretty well defended. They've got themselves quite well dug in. And there's also an issue, I think, which crops up repeatedly, actually, that taking small places like islands is really quite hard work, because in a sense, you cannot surround a fortified citadel if some of it is surrounded by sea quite so easily. So they're quite well placed, and they also have access, the knights have access to a very good Italian siege engineer called Gabriele Tadini, who is very good at defending these kinds of places.
Who is the sultan who decides to take it? Is that Suleiman?
This is Suleiman. Suleiman, he has just become sultan, and it is the requirement for any sultan to start his reign with, to legitimize his reign with a conquest. He needs money to build a mosque. Each new sultan has to build a mosque, but he also needs funds for his army, both in terms of providing justification, if you like, for having this army, but also to reward people and to bind in the loyalty of unique standing army, which the Ottomans had. So this is very, very important. The first thing you do as a sultan is go and conquest something. Actually, he'd just taken Belgrade, and then he decided he'd go for the Knights of St. John in Rhodes because they're an affront to the dignity of the sultan.
It's almost like they're a cross between the Rome of the Republic, where you have this incredibly aggressive animal, and the Rome of the Empire, where you have a fantastically well-organized standing army. It's almost like they combine these two facets in the one institution. But it is very interesting to me, anyway, just how aggressive the Ottoman Turks are throughout their history.
Yeah, I mean, somebody said, Turkish expansion is like the sea. It never has peace, but always rolls. And the thing that Christendom had to learn was that these guys would keep coming and coming, pushing out, particularly for land, rather like the Romans settling veterans on land, settling retired janissaries on land was part of the deal, really. And in a way, the sultans are riding a tiger, because if they cannot provide this kind of payoff for their troops, they're going to be in trouble, and there will be riots. It's a question of really who is ruling who in this. And what starts out as an incredibly sophisticated and advanced military machine can also be a liability for a sultan if he gets it wrong.
Suleiman is personally invested in the campaign against Rhodes, and I think he actually comes to the siege, is that right? And he is there throughout the siege, have I got that right?
He is, and it was intended upon the sultan to be there in the front line. And he's there for 5 months, which is actually a very, very long time. Ottoman sieges in the 16th century usually lasted about 40 or 50 days. They always went for the quick knockout blow. And it says something for how difficult it was to take Rhodes that it took them 5 months. Really, what does it is not cannon fire, but it's miners. The siege skills of the Ottomans are remarkable, but he brings an awful lot of silver miners from the Balkans to undermine these high-tech bastions, and then you plant explosives underneath and bring them down. And that, in the end, is what forces the knights to surrender. And it's unusual in the history of Ottoman siege warfare that it was a rather gentlemanly surrender, where the Grand Master of the Knights of St. John goes and surrenders, and they're allowed to leave with their goods and chattels, not allowed to take their cannon with them, and sail off into the sunset. And as far as Suleiman is concerned, that's the end of the story. But actually, it's not. It's the beginning of the story, because it's a very, very bad mistake to let the Knights of St. John go. They are going to, at the 40 years down the road, they're going to be a big thorn in his side at Malta.
And I guess for Suleiman personally, the siege must have been quite dangerous, if not so much from being injured by cannonballs or whatever, but from disease perhaps, because to spend 5 months in one place with a large army must have been pretty disease-ridden. So what were the casualties like in the siege? Because it lasted, 5 months, you say? Did they lose a ton of men to the knights? Did they lose a lot to disease?
I don't know about disease. Actually, the Ottomans are very good at camping. These are nomadic people. And I mean, when you hear them talking about the chaos of Christian encampments, the Ottomans are completely dismissive of their. They understand hygiene. They understand that you have to have bath houses, you have to have latrines, you dig trenches, you bury your dead properly, you lay your tents out in neat rows. And so, actually, any army, certainly in the height of summer, is going to be susceptible to disease. But the Ottomans were much better at it than the Christians ever were. So I don't know. I mean, they would have lost a lot of men, because at the end of the day, once you've made a breach in the walls, there comes a point when you have to inspire your men to go and do or die. And usually, given the position of the defenders, an awful lot of people are going to get mowed down. So they almost certainly do lose a lot of men. And of course, the call to religion becomes very important in that case, as far as the Ottomans are concerned, that you are doing this for the faith. And there's a whole psychological psyching up process goes on before the days, a couple of days before the final assault, when you have fasting and feasting and light fires and so on. But they would have lost a lot of men, and I don't know how many. I mean, there were only 500 knights in all this. Obviously, there were other people there as well. They would have had other soldiers, probably Greeks, I think, mainly, who would have fought with them. But the numbers are hugely disparate. But, I mean, I think for Suleiman, he was probably okay on the disease front. He probably had a luxury bathhouse and all that kind of stuff.
So he's fine. He's fine.
Yeah, he's going to be okay, yeah.
So they don't quite manage to take Rhodes, but neither can the knights hold it. And in the end, the knights just accept that the end is inevitable, and it's not worth it for Suleiman to press home because of the losses. But on the other hand, the knights know that if he has to, he will, and that'll be the end of them. So they kind of are invited to leave, and they accept the offer, quite understandably, I suppose.
Yeah, and that exactly sums it up, yeah.
So another player in this is, and you made the point about this, the Western Mediterranean and the Eastern Mediterranean, and Rhodes couldn't be any further to the east than the Mediterranean. But should we just say a bit about what's happening over in the West, and in particular Spain and their struggles in North Africa?
Yes. Spain in 1517 becomes, by a complicated issue of descendants, becomes part of the Habsburg Empire, which of course stretches in a sort of checkerboard all the way from Spain through parts of Europe, the Netherlands, Hungary, Austria, and so on. But in the Mediterranean, Spain has interests that really stretch from the Spanish mainland through the Balearic Islands, Mallorca, and so on, Sardinia, Corsica, and Spanish Italy, which is an idea I always find, or the Spanish Netherlands. So that's their field of operation, really. And a big wedge in the middle, which is a problem for them, actually, is France, which, of course, has some of that coastline along, Provence and Toulouse and so on, with whom the Habsburgs, Charles V, are loggerheads, really, because Charles wins the bribery race to become Holy Roman Emperor, and the King of France is rather put out about it. So they've actually got long lines of communication between their Spanish hub and their Italian hub. At the same time, they've shot themselves in the foot at the end of the 15th century by expelling most of their Muslim population. And where do they go? They go to North Africa. They've been pushed out. The Inquisition is also oppressing those Muslims who have left behind, who are normally converted to Christianity. But the expulsion of their population just over the water to North Africa really turns a coast which has always been given to piracy into a site of holy war. These people want revenge. They know Spain well. They speak Spanish. They know all the bays and the harbors. They know when villages are going to hold religious festivals by the side of the sea. And they are in a position to create a great deal of damage to the coasts of Spain and, in time, Italy, by corsair raiding from Tunis, Algiers, and various other sites along this coast. And this is going to become a major problem for Spain in the 16th century. At the same time, of course, of which it has global interests, and the Charles really sees himself as potentially a world emperor because they are reaching out to the Americas as well. And so we see them really hampered on their doorstep by this jihadi corsair pirate's nest, if you like, on the coast of North Africa. But at the same time, with ambitions to be world emperor. And this is going to cause them a great deal of trouble in the 16th century, dealing with the threat from North Africa.
And can you say a bit about the nature of warfare at that time? Because I was very struck by the way the galley system operated. So what are these galleys doing? What's the nature of these raids? What are they all about?
Yeah. The galley itself is an extraordinary machine, really. And it's a question to ask is, why on earth did anybody ever use them? They have a freeboard of about 4 foot from the water to the deck level. So they're very low in the water, increase the ergonomic efficiency of the oars. And of course, they require manpower to row them. They're very maneuverable. They can be fast. They have sails as well. But they're very extremely useful because they have no keel and you can haul them up on a beach. They're very good for maritime ambush. You can hide in a creek, you can nip out, and you can surround and take a sailing ship, which is finding it harder to maneuver. But in a way, they create their own requirement for warfare, because not only are they instruments of warfare and plundering, but they also require a limitless supply of manpower to power these machines. So half of the job really is raiding your neighbors' settlements and so on, and the other half is stealing men to be the cannon fodder, if you can put it like that, in your galley. And these are amoebic death traps, really. The life in a galley for somebody who isn't a seaman is short. And they do say that if you're downwind of a galley 2 miles, you can smell a galley because the conditions on it are just so ghastly. So the Corsairs of North Africa set out and they can mercilessly raid the coasts of Spain, grabbing people, plundering ships, and causing a huge amount of damage. And if you are a Corsair from anywhere in the Mediterranean, this is the go-to place to be. This is the Americas of opportunity, really, to get rich. And, of course, behind this is an ecological issue, which exists to this day, that the shores of the northern Mediterranean are wealthier and more fertile and more prosperous than the southern shores, really. There's no wood. There's a long-term case, really, for, you know, why do people migrate, want to cross the Mediterranean? Now, prospects are better on the other side. So we see a vast amount of man-taking going on, and women and children, of course, who will disappear into the harems of North Africa. And these become, you know, gold rush cities for people from all the way from the Eastern Mediterranean who want to engage in holy war disguised as piracy or vice versa.
And one thing that struck me particularly reading your book was just the sheer scale of the slaving that went on. So what were the slaves used for? I can see they'd be used in the galleys in vast amounts, and I guess their lifespan, as you say, would not be so long, so there'd be a lot of turnover there. But were they used for anything else, personal servants in agriculture?
Yeah, they would have been used in all those building projects, personal servants. Obviously, women would go into the harem. They could be traded. You know, you can buy and sell slaves to other people. They reckon that in a sort of 200-year period, about 2 million people from the northern shores of the Mediterranean disappeared into North Africa, because it is still going on into the middle of the 18th century. And indeed, I think in 1815, 150 people were taken off the island of Sardinia. So this goes on for a very long time.
Yeah, I think there's even cases where they raided as far as Britain and took people off the shores of Britain, maybe in the 1700s sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Off Cornwall and Ireland, you know, the Corsairs pitch up everywhere, really, yeah.
And from the Christian side, do they take slaves from North Africa when they get the chance?
They do. It's actually... But because of the wind system, it's more difficult. And obviously, the Islamic pirates have to sail back to North Africa, but they're making raids on North Africa are actually slightly more tricky because of the winds and currents. But they do, and you don't hear about it so much. The Knights of St. John certainly take quite a lot of slaves, and when they set up on Malta, they have slave holding pens. But it's seems like fairly one-way traffic, actually. You know, the numbers are disparate, really, as far as we can see, partially because of the vast literature in the centuries of this activity, written in European languages, of tales of slavery, escape, liberation, and so on. But yes, they would certainly take Islamic ships and put those people to work in their galleys too.
So you brought up Malta. So the Knights of St. John, bless them, they've hot-footed it out of Rhodes, and they have moved over to Malta. So where is Malta? Can you just position it for us?
Malta is a little dot just off the coast of Sicily, and it's bang in the middle of the sea, really. You know, it's the midpoint between, you know, the point where the east and the western Mediterranean meet. It's extremely small, about 17 miles long. The Maltese are a kind of unique micro people who speak a kind of Arabic but are Catholics. And it's stony and barren, but thanks to geology, it has one great feature, which is fantastic deep sea harbors, which are enormously useful for sheltering ships. And Charles V of Spain, as he is at the moment, gifts, if gifts is the right word to describe it, the Malta to the knights, who would much rather have somewhere, you know, like Sardinia, I think, actually. And really, it's a bit of a hospital pass, you can put it like that, that he needs somebody to defend the center of the Mediterranean from merciless raiding. So they get Malta, which is barren and stony and has very little going for it in terms of agriculture. But that's all they're offered, and that's where they set up in about 1530, I think. And this is really now becomes the front line in terms of defense of the central Mediterranean from the incursions, both of the pirate raids of North Africa and from the growing imperial navy of Suleiman the Magnificent.
So Suleiman is still going by this stage.
Suleiman had a very long reign, from about 1519 to 1566, I think. Yeah, 40 years, yeah.
Gosh, that's almost the same as something like Augustus, I guess. No, that's not bad. So they've set up in Malta, and I think you said in your book that, they, as you say, it was a hospital pass, because not only did they have to defend Malta, they were also given a bit of the African coast to look after, which mustn't have been terribly comfortable, although I think they lost that in due course.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, fairly quickly. I mean, they realized it was undefendable. So they fortify Malta reasonably well, and they go back to their activities, which are making actually quite long-distance raids into the Eastern Mediterranean on what they call the caravan, which is not something you tow behind your car, but was a small flotilla of ships that would set out. They only had about 3 or 4 galleys, and they did definitely have, these ships are definitely rowed by Muslim slaves, creating mayhem in the Eastern Mediterranean as much as they can, raiding the Hajj ships, raiding grain fleets, and eventually they exhaust the pride of Suleiman by capturing a ship called the Sultana, which has a huge amount of wealth on it and includes the very much loved nurse of Suleiman's daughter, who is reputed to have been 107. And who is taken off to Malta. And this is the last straw. This is the last straw for Suleiman. His pride as caliph of the Islamic world is at stake here. And this is now intolerable. So the nest of vipers, as it was called by Suleiman, has to be exterminated. And so they're going to set out on a huge long-distance strike, 800 miles from Istanbul, to take Malta. At the same time, they summon up their allies in the Western Mediterranean, the Corsair pirate kings, to participate. And so this converges on Malta in 1565.
And the knights, as you say, have been making themselves thoroughly unpopular with the Ottoman Turks while they've been on Malta. So are they what we would call fundamentalists, where they are engaged in holy war, or are they doing this for profit, or what is their motivation for causing all this mayhem?
It is, I think, basically religious, that they are almost people out of their own time, who there's a certain amount of military tourism that goes on, actually. Some people will just come over for a couple of years and do their military service and then go back to their estate in France. But they are committed to holy war. Obviously, they do grab, and this does enrich their economy, but it also continues to provide them with funds from the papacy and from, you know, that they are doing Christian work, that they are involved in crusading effort, in repelling the increasingly frightening advance of the Turks, you know, into Central Europe, round the coast of North Africa, attacks on Italy. Suleiman had pretensions for capturing Rome and declaring himself to be Caesar. So they have enormous value to people, and the papacy pumps money into them. But these guys are committed to holy war. There's no doubt about it.
And just as an aside, you say that Suleiman has as one of it's on his to-do list, you know, conquer Rome. And it's not completely far-fetched, is it? Because the size of the army that he can put into the field is enormous.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think the issue really is transportation. And Malta undoubtedly would be a very good base camp for an assault on mainland Italy. I mean, they've been raiding the coast one way or another. The Barbarossas, who are the pirate kings of North Africa, have been raiding the west coast of Italy quite mercilessly. There have been landings on the heel of Italy in Calabria in the 1480s, quite substantial. I think they held Otranto for a while. So the existential fear of an advance on Rome was great. And there were moments when you can almost see the Pope feeling, certainly with the raiding of the west coast, that they did it occasionally, I think, more than once, just pack up and leave Rome for a bit, because the fear of the Ottoman threat was so great in one form or another, either the pirates or the mainstream Sultan's forces.
So they decide to take Malta. And as you say, it's an astonishing expedition to be able to go from Istanbul, 800 miles, did you say, to be able to do that with a vast army with a vast collection of stores, just to organize something like that. It's quite an extraordinary undertaking, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, we think of the Ottomans as great fighters, but they're actually very good bean counters as well. The managing of the logistics, and we do actually have a record of the collection of supplies along the way. And, you know, various people along the coast are ordered to provide X amount of gunpowder, Y amount of corn. And so this is a very sophisticated operation. The problem is that the season for this really is quite short. They arrive in May, because it takes them a while to get going, and you can't sail too early in the year in a galley, because rough seas are going to swamp your ships. And they probably they've got a window between about May and September. It's not a long time if you're going to be confronted something similar to the siege of Rhodes. So it's very ambitious. You know, they're operating at their logistical and operational limits. Obviously, they have help from North Africa, which is much closer, but it's not integrated into a totally coherent plan.
Right, because the Ottoman Turks are in Istanbul and in Turkey, but it's not all under the government of Suleiman, is it, North Africa? It's not a unified governmental system.
No, it isn't. No, it's loosely federated, I would say. You know, they swear allegiance to Suleiman, but his ability to actually control in detail what's going on is not great. And they're sort of semi-detached, but they share overlapping hatred of the Knights and John, that's for sure.
Okay, so do you want to say a bit about what the fortifications of the Knights are in Malta?
Yeah, really, it hinges around this harbour, the Grand Harbour, which consists of two very deep inlets with a peninsula in the middle called Mount Shibrach and a couple of other little peninsulas coming out. And the Knights fortify these three little peninsulas, one which has a fort on the end, a place called St. Elmo, and then two others, which are almost joined together, just separated by a little bit of water. And the advantage of this really is that you can have as many troops as you want, but if the front that you're attacking is only 200 yards wide, it's actually very difficult to bring a large number of troops to bear at the same time. You can't, really. One of the difficulties for the Ottomans is this is a limestone rock landscape, and their numero uno tactic is mining. And mining is incredibly slow work in this landscape. So it's pretty tough going. And the Knights, first of all, at the end of this little star fort at St. Elmo, are able to dig themselves in, and they're inaccessible to easy attack by sea because it's a rocky coast and you can't easily get at them. So the Ottomans are forced to make very, very slow progress to take these sites one after another. St. Elmo is their first point, and this takes them about 6 weeks, and it's a ghastly and bloody struggle in which the knights, who are probably about 100 of them there with various other troops, hunker down and make life extraordinarily difficult for them. In the end, the Grand Master there from one of the other peninsulas refuses to send any more troops over, and they go down to the last man in a kind of heroic Alamo situation, really, you could say. They're helped enormously by the local population, the Maltese, Arabic speaking, and whose word for God, I understand, for God is Allah, but they're Catholics, provided a huge amount of help. They sent swimmers out from St. Elmo with messages. They created quite a lot of trouble in elsewhere in the islands, and they provided all kinds of communication with Sicily. We're going out in little ships and so on. So the first point, St. Elmo, is taken after a very, very bloody struggle. They're then forced to take the other two peninsulas, which pose similar problems. And the terrain is very inhospitable. Water is a problem. And you talked earlier about health, and actually health does come into an issue here, because they're forced to camp where there is a water source, but it is also extremely marshy. And over a 4 or 5 month period, Malta is incredibly humid in the summer. It picks up water off the sea. They get sick, and people certainly do start dying of disease. It's very hard to get a decent diet. They're pummeling away at these little fortifications. But there's also a problem with the command structure, which Suleiman hasn't been terribly wise over. The admiral of the fleet, who is called Piali, and the admiral of the army, who's Mustafa, have different views of what's going on. Piali's main concern is to keep his fleet safe, because if they're trapped there, they've had it. And he is ardently keen not to stay too long. Mustafa's reputation depends upon taking these fortifications and taking the island. So this tension goes on in unresolved command structure, really, which kind of slightly undermines the single-mindedness of their effort. This goes on from May until September. This should have been a pushover, actually, for the Christians, because they're only 60 miles from Christian Sicily, and a relief force could come very easily. Actually, this is matched further down the road by the sieges of Vienna, where, again, the Ottomans take so long to get to Vienna to take a city that they haven't got enough time to take it. And the same thing echoes here. And it should have been easy for a Christian relief force to come. But Philip II, who is now King of Spain, is very cautious. He's lost fleets off the coast of North Africa. He doesn't want to take a risk. And he really sits on his hands for as long as he possibly can. And he's almost prepared to see the knights go down, really. Malta wasn't worth the candle, wasn't worth the risk. But in the end, he does send the relief force in September, which lands about 10,000 men. There's a final battle, and the Ottomans are routed. They manage to take to their ships in reasonable numbers. An awful lot of them are killed. And this is a victory. And this has enormous psychological benefit for the morale of Christendom, who have been losing battles. This is the first battle that the Ottomans have lost since, I think, the Battle of Ankara in 1402. They failed to take Vienna in the late 1520s, I think. But generally, it's been a one-way ticket. This also is the beginning of war reporting, actually. It's very interesting. You get reports in real time going back across Europe at enormous speed, people drawing maps of what's going on, sending them out. And they were ringing the bells in London, although the Catholic thing didn't resonate quite so loudly in Protestant Elizabethan England. But this has taken as a real morale raiser for the people of Europe. They won something, really.
At last.
And it seemed like they might have stopped the Ottoman advance, certainly at sea. So it was a moment, really, but although it really didn't perhaps change anything, but it made Christians feel better for a while.
Yes, it must have been absolutely terrifying at the time, just seeing the steady advance year after year, sweeping past Constantinople, which is this extraordinary city, and then seeing it carry on up the Balkans, seeing it carry on up through Hungary.
Yeah.
getting closer and closer. And
as
you say, battle after battle being lost, there must have been a sense of the remorselessness of it, at least.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think, you know, there is a huge anti-Turk literature. One of the first uses of printing was printing indulgences in about 1480 for people to go on crusade against the Ottomans. And the literature of the terrible Turk is very rich in the 16th century, you know, histories of the Turk. It crops up a bit in Shakespeare in various ways. They were kind of very, very large in the imagination of Europe.
Just remind me, Mustafa, he's the commander of the army. Piali's the commander of the fleet. What happens to the pair of them? Do they make it through the siege?
They both make it through the siege, and they do miraculously survive Suleiman's displeasure, which is unusual, actually, really. And usually it's kind of a head-off job for, you know, failing, and somehow they made it back again, and they, you know, they survived at the end of their careers, that's for sure, yeah.
And does Mustafa, does he personally try hard, or is he a man who leads from the back?
There are reports of Mustafa complaining that the bombardment of the walls of the Christian enclave in the early afternoon was disturbing his siesta.
Oh, dear.
I guess they were trying pretty hard.
But they do lose. They must lose over half their army in this whole thing, one way or another. I mean, it is a catastrophic defeat just in terms of sheer numbers.
I mean, I think by the time it got back to Istanbul, the news was blunted a bit. It was quite common for there to have victory celebrations even after you failed to take Vienna in 1529, you know. And people really are not going to know, as long as you don't spread it around too much. But there was certainly for the Janissaries, the crack troops, really did not want to go on the maritime seaborne expeditions. The people of the land, they really disliked them. They didn't want to do them, actually.
Let's talk about another player in all this, which you've actually got an entire book about, which is the Venetians. And they are fairly ambiguous people when it comes to holy war against the Turks, because on the whole, they would just much rather do business, right?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, Venice's wealth was founded on the spice trade with Alexandria, and they spent an awful, in the 14th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, they spent an awful lot of time in the Levant, in Egypt, in Alexandria, in Damascus, in Acre, and obviously later in Constantinople. They had no appetite for crusading. They were routinely ticked off by the Pope for not showing any enthusiasm for holy war. They regarded the Knights of St. John as corsairs with crosses, but they, of course, are trying to appease an ogre, really, in terms of the Ottomans. They'd fought some long and difficult wars in the 15th century, what's called the Long War, that went on, in which they lost a lot of their position in Greece and their islands. So they were trying to play it both ways, really. They wanted to trade with the Ottomans, and Ottomans probably had things that they wanted, particularly war materials of various sorts. And they really did not have any truck with the idea of a united Christendom. They just wanted to get on with selling this stuff.
Okay, so let's talk about Cyprus a bit, because that Cyprus is ruled by Venice. And reading your book, it's slightly shocking the way they carried out their government there. Do you want to say a bit about how they treated the locals?
Yeah. Effectively, Venice gets hold of Cyprus, I think, in the 14th century. And it really becomes a colonial exploitation. It's a sort of precursor of plantation colonialism. They've transported sugar and cotton from the Middle East, because they spent a long time in the Middle East. And they really have kind of, not quite a sort of feudal slave plantations there of the downtrodden Greeks. You know, they're vassals, if you like. In fact, actually, being a subject of the Venetian Maritime Empire anyway wasn't great. But Cyprus was enormously valuable in terms of resource extraction. They were making a great deal of money out of sugar and cotton, and so it had great value to them. And so, you know, it was very, very important. But of course, this is far into the Eastern Mediterranean, and it's only 60 miles from the coast of Turkey. So, you know, the chances of taking Cyprus from Venice are much greater than taking Malta from the Knights of St. John.
And so that's what they decide to do. And I guess the whole of the Christian West, if I can call it that, is alarmed by this and starts to mobilize to stop them doing it. And it's slightly confusing, but at this stage, the papacy seems to have become more active and become more persuasive amongst the councils of Christendom, if I've understood your book correctly. And so they do start to organize to defend Cyprus. But what I don't really understand is why the Ottomans really feel the need to take Cyprus from Venetians, who are effectively, you know, a dagger in the back of Christendom if they choose to use them in that particular way and put an end to the cooperation.
Well, Suleiman dies in 1565, and his son, Selim the Sot, first sultan who never went on crusade, but he needs a conquest for reasons that I explained earlier. You have to legitimize, and there was a riot of the Janissary troops who called him the ox behind his back at the start of his reign. So he's got to provide some money, effectively, and he cannot build a mosque. So legitimacy depends upon conquest. And so there are one or two viziers in the Ottoman court who suggests that taking Cyprus would be a juicy piece of land. You can give out, you know, land holdings to people, and you've legitimized your reign. So really the reasons for this are really tied up with the Ottomans' succession. The Christians learned slowly, but did learn that every new sultan, you breathe a sigh of relief because he's not like the last one, but actually he's going to have to do exactly the same thing for the last one, because he needs to show that he's top guy and command allegiance and give out gifts. So this really is the rationale for going for Cyprus. And the Venetians who are defending this in Nicosia and Famagusta, the two centers of population, do find themselves in a situation where they have to eat humble pie a bit and cooperate, really, and really ask for help. The other thing is that we get a new pope at this time, Pope Pius V. He has the zeal to resurrect the idea of crusade, a mission to save Cyprus, and he manages to cobble together with some difficulty some support from Spain. The reason why Spain, whose interests really stop at Sicily, get suddenly interested is that the Ottomans have been stirring up trouble even in Spain, in southern Spain, and there's a revolt by the Moriscos, the only half-converted Christian Muslims, and the possibility that the Ottomans might make a strike into Spain, you know, a mainstream strike, and this is probably a diversionary tactic, which has the reverse effect of really dragging Spain out of its Western Mediterranean isolation into participating in a long-range mission to Cyprus, with a proviso that Philip, who is very cautious, actually says to the commander, Gian Andrea Doria, don't risk the ships. they have the rather pointless mission that goes out, sails around a bit and comes back again, by which time Nicosia is taken and Famagusta is under siege. And the Venetians make a mess of Nicosia, and it's taken quite easily. But Famagusta, they put up a spirited defense. And again, mining sort of brings down the walls in the end. And they have a negotiated surrender, which goes horribly wrong, because the Ottoman commander, treacherously detains the Venetian commander, Bragadine, and has him skinned alive. And this is going to become a cause which is going to come back to haunt the Ottomans sometime afterwards. He's broken a truce on some small pretext, which really wasn't there, and this ghastly event unfolds.
And I think you said in your book that the guy who carries out the skinning, and I don't know if he's chosen specifically for his religion, but he's a Jewish butcher. And this, again, has terrible consequences for the Jewish community in Venice.
Yeah, this guy is told to do it. And butchering was one of the trades which the Jews could do. And this guy was probably just there and was told to do it. And yes, this is going to unleash a wave of anti-Semitic behavior in Venice. This idea of, you know, there are all sorts of side ramifications to this terrible event, which is going to be extremely bad news for the Jews, actually.
Again, I think you sort of hinted this, that he breaks the truce for no great reason. And it just seems, again, extraordinarily short-sighted, because there's nothing in it for him particularly to do this. He is simply a man of cruelty, I suppose. And again through your book, one is just taken by the incredible cruelty, the senseless waste of life, the senseless cruelty of both sides against each other. It really is quite astonishing to read.
It is. It's astonishing to write. I mean, there are times when, you know, I find myself flinching as I'm writing this stuff, actually, because certainly a lot of the things that the Corsairs did in North Africa, you know, these pyramids, skulls, all kinds of stuff that people are doing. And it does happen on both sides. It certainly does. And one of the problems in this history, when we think about who committed the cruelest deeds, is that we have a disparity of sources. Europe is now the age of printing, and there's a vast amount being written, first-hand accounts of events. The Ottomans are not going to get to printing until the 18th century, and their history is mainly oral. So when you're trying to see things from the Ottoman point of view, a lot of the time you're having to read between the lines. So really, finding Ottoman sources, I can't read Ottoman Turkish, you know, but they're great accounts, I think, of quantities of this and that, but they don't write first-hand autobiographical accounts. And that's one of the reasons why it's much more difficult to level up the story. I would love to find, you know, first-hand accounts of, but you're scraping a barrel all the time looking for stuff that might be usable. And so, you know, it's hard not to give the impression that the Ottomans and the Islamic world were genetically cruel, really, were ghastly people. And, you know, we can't necessarily say that, but it's very difficult to manage the information well, I think.
It is interesting, isn't it? It's like the Ottomans belong to the ancient world, and there are very few sort of first-person accounts, first-person diaries from the ancient world, the same way that you get later on in, you know, during the Renaissance and after that. It's most curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Famagusta and Nicosia have both fallen. So I guess Cyprus has fallen now, but the expeditionary force which is there to rescue it, that the fleet that they've put together, is still in existence. So what happens next?
What happens next is that Pius manages to broker an agreement between Philip of Spain's Spanish navy, the Venetians, the Knights of St. John, and papal forces, which he'd pay for himself. This is no mean feat. And it's very fragile. But for reasons that I explained earlier about the Spanish suddenly realizing that they had an interest in the wave of Ottoman conquest, which could well come to their doors, he manages to bring this force together with a great deal of difficulty. And it slowly converges. The forces come together in Sicily in a very slow motion gathering of vessels and men, and vast numbers of ships. But again, Philip has given slightly treacherous instructions to his admirals to actually, you know, don't take any risks. And not taking any risks is really what it's about. The problem is that The leader of this is Don Juan of Austria, the illegitimate half-brother of Philip. And Don Juan has a role to create for himself. He needs to do great deeds. He wants to be somebody in the world. He's being continuously slighted. And therefore, he is there for glory, really. And he also has no seaborne experience. So on the other side, we have an Ottoman commander, Muezzinzadeh Ali Pasha, the son of the Muezzin, who also had something to prove. He comes from an ethnic Turkish background. He's going to be commander of a gathering Ottoman fleet. And actually, ethnic Turks do not prosper in the Ottoman Empire. They're almost all people from other racial backgrounds. So he's a bit of an outsider.
I mean, I did think that was terribly funny in your book, that the people that you would think would be the insiders are actually the outsiders, and the people who are the insiders are actually people who are originally Christians, for example.
Yes. It is odd, but it's Ottoman paranoia, really. The aim is to crush the aspirations of a sort of nascent Turkish nobility who might develop insurrection against you. So the people who rise to the top are captured slaves, captured as children, mainly from the Balkans, actually, educated, very bright kids who rise up through the ranks, but owe all their position and power to the Sultan. They have no other power base. So these people are completely dependent upon him. And so you tend to get these guys who are, Serbian or Greek or Albanian, who really become the Sultan's top viziers. But Muezzinzadeh is not one of these. He's kind of slipped through the net a bit, actually, somehow. And so he's got something to prove as well. So we start to see a kind of developing sense of a huge maritime force gathering at the two ends of the Mediterranean. Now, galley battles are very rare because anybody who is a bright commander, they're very risky. Nobody could, it's very hard to see who's going to win a galley battle. And the very bright commanders of the age of Suleiman and of Charles are people actually who on the whole avoid battles. And the great Genoese admiral, Andrea Doria, was very keen to avoid battles. He hired himself out, but he owned his own galleys. He obviously wasn't going to risk them in a real fight. And there was a sort of feeling that him and his opponent, Barbarossa, kind of fudged the sea battles. The Spanish have a saying about this, apparently. One crow does not peck out another crow's eyes.
Very cynical.
Yeah, very cynical. But when you get to this, we've got two guys. We've got Don Juan, who's hungry for fame. And we've got the son of the Muezzin. And we have wise heads telling Don Juan, people who know a lot about sea battles, don't risk your fleet. Don't risk your fleet. This is very, very dangerous. If your fleet's wiped out, we've had it. We have absolutely had it. But they're driven forward by a range of forces. I mean, the Christian effort is very fractured, with Philip's commanders sort of dragging back, the Venetians desperate to get revenge for the loss of Cyprus. They don't yet know about Bragadin, and they're fighting in the streets of Sicily where the Italian and the Spanish soldiers meet. But somehow it's held together. It's held together until they're in the Adriatic, when there's a massive row between the Venetian sort of crusty commander Venier and some Spaniards. And Venier threatens to blow the Spaniards out of the water. It's just about patched up. And at that moment, word comes of the skinning of Bragadin. And this makes the Venetians say, whatever happens, we are going to go and fight this battle. And Don Juan is definitely up for it. The Spanish get dragged along against Philip's long-distance orders. Ditto, the Ottomans are organizing their navy. Both sides, unfortunately, have very poor intelligence facilities, because both of them send out scouts. You try and find out what the enemy's doing, and both of them meet Greek fishermen. The Greeks don't really like either side. Both tell the same story to the people they meet. They say to the Christians, actually, the Ottoman fleet is much smaller than yours, and vice versa. So These two fleets, this is an Olympic gathering of ships, which has never been seen before, galleys, 100 ships on each side, thousands of men. I can't remember the numbers now, but, we may be talking about 100,000 men on these ships. So they're slowly on a collision course off the coast of Greece, and sort of horror unfolds as they get within sight of each other that this is a big deal. This is going to be the mother of all battles, and it's too late to draw back. So on a morning in early October 1573, the 5th of October, these two fleets are rowing towards each other in the sunlight of a beautiful October day. It's an extraordinary event in maritime history.
And you say you can't remember exactly how many were killed in the battle, but I mean, it was a crushing defeat for the Ottomans in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember how many people took part. I know that 40,000 men died in 4 hours, a rate of fatality in a battle that was not surpassed, I think, until battle in the First World War, 1915. It was absolute carnage, really, because the thing about galleys is that you could have a gun at the front, but you could only fire in front of you. And if your ship is outmaneuvered and is attacked from the side, you are literally dead in the water. So the Christians do slightly better, actually, because Venetians come up with some sort of gunboats called galleasses, which they tow in front of the fleet and do a quite a good wrecking job at the beginning of the battle. And the advantage becomes asymmetrical after a while. And so the losses are massive in terms of, particularly of the Ottoman fleet. And, a small number of ships survive and sail away. But it is a huge victory for the Christians, huge victory.
Presumably the Christian losses are also pretty substantial.
They are very great, yeah, they are. Many, many men die on both sides, but more on the Ottoman side.
And why do the Christian ships win? And perhaps as much to the point, could it have easily gone the other way, or was it a one-sided fight?
It was probably decided by the fact that the Venetian innovation of these effectively gunships, they had these galleasses, which are slightly heavy galleys, very slow. They had them towed in front of the fleet as the enemy were advancing. And they had cannons on their sides, so they could fire broadside. And so as the Ottoman fleet advanced and tried to pass these, about six of them, they were sitting targets. And so the Ottoman line was disarrayed and shattered in places from the off. And so in galley warfare, what you need to do is to keep your ships close enough together that an enemy can't insert itself, but far enough apart so you don't clash oars. But when you get a hole between your line, then the enemy can insert himself and attack your ship sideways. And that effectively is what the Christians are then able to do. So although it was hard fought in parts, it became one-sided fairly quickly. And really, it was that early initiative by the Venetians which swung the battle to the Christian victory.
And you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, but I got the sense in your book that, yes, the battle mattered enormously in that if what had happened to the Ottomans had happened to the Christian side, that would have made a big difference to the world of the Mediterranean. But that, as it was, the thing effectively continued in stalemate after the battle. And in a sense, the attention of the world was switching elsewhere as the Portuguese and the Spanish find their way around Africa and you have the New World opening up. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I think that is fair. I mean, it's an interesting moment. It's much debated. Was this the battle that led nowhere? And in a way, you could say that it didn't alter the balance of power. The Ottomans went back, built another fleet the next year, 100 ships, and sailed out again. Both sides actually tacitly disengaged from this point, although there was a little bit of, and signed a treaty in the 1580s, which effectively divided the Mediterranean in two. But the cost of these fleets is huge, actually. They're massively expensive things to build and maintain and so on. And you start to see hairline cracks appearing in the economies of both superpowers. Philip defaults on his debts in 1575, and the 1580s we start to see the Ottomans devalue their coinage. And we really start to see the hairline cracks appearing within the Ottoman economic prospect, really. And so we could take this, I suppose, as a moment at which, you know, when does the decline of the Ottoman Empire start? It's one of those moot points. But you can make a point that this was really a moment of reckoning for their prospects. And we start to see a stress, I think, on the Ottoman imperial system at that point. But over and beyond that, you're right. I think at this point, we start to see certainly the energy of Spain and the energy of Europe being turned outwards into new seas, the Atlantic venture, which eventually, of course, is going to suck in all the countries of Europe, Northern Europe. And, I mean, it's a slow decline to the Mediterranean becoming a backwater. But this is a point, really, at which the Venetians, you know, who benefited hugely from Mediterranean trade, really start to see their morphing really from a trading city into a cultural city. So like a lot of these things, the contest itself is not critical, but it's iconic, really. It's, you know, it's one of those moments that marks something like the fall of Acre in 1291 was, you know, a moment that was going to happen whatever. You know, the Crusaders are going to be pushed out of the Holy Land. It didn't cause them to be pushed out of the Holy Land. They were going to be pushed out as one of those moments that a handy kind of reference point, I think, in saying, oh, that's the end of the Crusades. You know, this is the point at which the Mediterranean, which has been the economic powerhouse of Europe, the Italian city-states, the trade with the Islamic world and so on, the Renaissance, the energy starts to go elsewhere. It starts to go to the edges of the periphery of Europe. And maybe the Battle of Lepanto is kind of one of those markers that of that process, really, that, you know, they'd fought themselves to a standstill. The game wasn't worth the candle, if you like, anymore.
And there was a rather melancholy coda. Well, it's always melancholy because everybody must die, but I thought poor old Don Juan, that was a particularly sad story.
It was, yes, he dies of something. I can't remember what he died of.
Dysentery, I think, or something of that sort.
In the Spanish Netherlands, yeah, a man who thought that, you know, that he was going to become, like, you know, I don't know, he, you know, he'd had dreams, I suppose, of becoming, you know, king of Spain after Philip or something, of, you know, being given a crown, and he dies a disappointed man, really.
And one of the few people in it all who seems to come out of it with, you know, total credit, because he is personally courageous. He fights and wins the Battle of Lepanto. And then afterwards, he's one of the few people who behaves with real chivalry, releasing some Turkish prisoners on the petition of, I think, is it the niece of the Sultan? I can't remember.
Yes, I think so. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they all die disappointed men. Suleiman, 40 years in power. He's a haggard, exhausted man. Charles V retreats into a monastery and spends his time taking watches and clocks apart and putting them back again. These are people who have tried to manage world empires and have been crushed by the burden of the job. You know, the imperial systems are not sophisticated enough, administrative capability to manage, you know, these huge empires, and they destroy the people who nominally are the head of them.
Shall we leave it there? That was an absolutely terrific tour de force, and I will just recommend again the book Empires of the Sea, which was one of my favorite reads, and so I was just delighted to be able to get the chance to talk to you about it. And have you just released a book? Is it, I think you mentioned Acre there?
Last year, a book about the end of the Crusades, the fall of Acre, called The Accursed Tower. Yes, was really an earlier part of the story of the Knights of St. John and the Templars, really, their last hurrah in the Holy Land.
And what's next?
I'm writing a book about the Spanish and the Portuguese in the Far East, effectively. It takes in the circumnavigation of the world, the contest for the Moluccas, the spice trade, the ability of the Spanish to learn to sail the Pacific, and the contact with China and Japan. And my problem is the source material by this stage You just can't stop those printing presses by the middle of the 16th century.
Yes, there's something to be said for being an historian of the Roman Empire. There's just not too much to...
And I do not understand how anybody can write a book about the Second World War.
Okay, well, yeah. Thank you very much indeed. And I hope to have you back on again, perhaps to talk about one of your other books.
Yeah, well, be pleased to do it. And yeah, sorry about the rustling of the paper.
Not at all. Well, that's the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed listening, and if you did, do please join me for the next episode. And if you have the time, please do recommend me to your friends. And a share on social media, and maybe a review on iTunes, really helps my guests get the audience they deserve. Goodbye for now.